B-Pod Studios.
Today on Talkin' Rock with Meltdown.
Trans-Siberian guitarist Al Petrelli is up first as they get set to live stream their concert this coming Friday. Of course, things are a little bit different this year in the midst of a pandemic.
Yeah, dude, it's been like the most emotional slash best couple weeks of my career because I'm so proud of everybody.
Since TSO has an East Coast and a West Coast band, I asked him who was going to be playing in the band this weekend for the live stream. We talk about his military sons as well as his time in Megadeth. Did he ask David Ellefson, Megadeth's bassist, to join TSO?
Absolutely. This was when TSO was just kind of, you know, stretching its legs a little bit.
Up next is Jason Bieler. His record's called Songs for the Apocalypse. That drops on January 22nd with tons of musical guests. I asked him if there was any guests he couldn't get on the record for whatever reason.
No one said no. I mean, strangely enough, I think it came more to time constraints and the label's lack of putting out a nine-fold album.
We dive deep into the record. We talk about Frank Zappa as well as his time in Saigon Kick when Jason pulled out this gem, talking about their hits, Love Is On The Way.
That was a final ballad, which really, when you think about it, paved the way for grunge. I like to think of myself as the godfather of grunge, had I not killed hair metal off.
I have no words. Jason Bieler and Al Petrelli today on Talkin' Rock.
This is Talkin' Rock. Talkin' Rock. Your backstage pass to some of your favorite rock artists. Here's your host, Meltdown.
Two really fun conversations on Talkin' Rock with Meltdown today. Of course, Al Petrelli up first with the Trans-Siberian Orchestra doing their live streaming thing coming up this weekend as I record this, coming up on December 18th. We'll talk with Al here in just a second. And then Jason Bieler, he's got this new record out called Songs for the Apocalypse. I want to keep saying Songs from the Apocalypse, but Songs for the Apocalypse with the Baron von Bielski Orchestra on January 22nd. I'll get into all the special guests he's got on this record coming up here in just a bit. And this was a really funny conversation, as you could probably tell from that little excerpt in the intro. So Jason is a really funny guy, and this record's really killer. So we'll get into that coming up here in just a couple minutes. In the meantime, I was connected to Al Petrelli through one of these three-way calls like I've talked about several times before, and we were off and running with Al, who I haven't seen in a very long time, as he starts us off today on Talkin' Rock.
What's up, my brother? How are you today?
I'm doing good. I met you a billion years ago in Widowmaker back in Buffalo in those days with Dee Snider.
We're so old.
I don't think I've seen or interviewed or talked to you since, but I guess everybody wants to know, when's the Widowmaker reunion?
Well, you know what? Not too far from the truth, dude, because I speak to Dee and Joe and those guys, you know, every so often, and, you know, they're always kind of toying around with the idea. And I said, look, man, you know, what we've all learned this past year in 2020 is don't put anything off ever again, because we don't know that tomorrow's ever a guarantee anymore, you know? So I know I'd love to do it, and, you know, who knows? Who knows? So let me get through the rest of this year first, and I'll talk about anything, you know?
I'm kind of being facetious, of course, but, man, I'll tell you what, I love that Widowmaker stuff. That was so cool.
Thanks. Yeah. It was so much fun, and I was listening to a couple tracks not too long ago, and I was like, damn, this was good.
Yeah, that was good. Right after Dee, of course, left Twisted, and that was kind of a wild time in your life. That was now, correct me if I'm wrong, since you've lived it, but that was before Sabotage. That was what did you come out of? But to get into Widowmaker, where was that?
Alice Cooper.
That's right. Okay. Yep. I knew there was something. Yeah.
So it was like going from Alice Cooper to Dee Snider. It was like, wow. That's what I got to say about that. Wow.
Yeah. And you just mentioned something about how, you know, tomorrow's not guaranteed and that, you know, you got to do what you can. And I was texting with Dave Ellefson last night, and he told me that you're kind of the guy responsible for him with his never say no attitude.
Yep. Yeah, listen, David has been a brother for 20 years, ever since I worked with him in Megadeth, you know, and I came from a different mindset than he did. You know, he moved to L.A., I think, you know, 18, 19 years old. He met Mustaine. They started a band, and that was it, you know. Me, I was a session player, you know, and I learned that you just say yes to everybody, you know, and you act like the airlines. You overbook and figure it out if there's a problem later, because you don't know where your next paycheck's coming from. And
right.
When I was in Megadeth, David and I spent a lot of time talking, And, you know, when the band kind of folded for a couple minutes, you know, I said, look, dude, welcome to my world now. You just keep saying yes to everybody. And, you know, I guess it served him pretty well because he put that in his book, and I've heard that story come back to me a couple times.
Yeah, he does. And he's got to be one of the busiest people that I know in this pandemic.
Truth.
Like, he never stops.
But he's like that always, man. He's got an incredible work ethic, and he's just an incredible human. I love him to death.
And of course, you know, we're here to plug TSO, and he said that you actually asked him one time to join TSO back in the day?
Absolutely. This was when TSO was just kind of, you know, stretching its legs a little bit. And obviously, you know, David and I, you know, I was with him in Megadeth for almost 2 years, and then it kind of, like, went on the back burner for a minute, and he's like, well, I'm not sure what to do. I was like, well, why don't you come work with me on this, you know? And he loved it. When I played him the first record when we were touring in Megadeth, he's like, dude, this stuff's awesome. I'm like, yeah, it's kind of cool. You know, we did a tour in 99, and then I joined Megadeth, and the record keeps selling, and it's getting a lot of airplay. I don't know what's going to happen with it. I said, but, you know. And he was interested. I don't remember exactly why he didn't get involved, but I just knew that everybody wanted him in, and, you know, I would have loved to continue working with the guy.
Now, according to him, I think that my text here right in front of me, but I think he said something along the lines, he was a little bit burned out, and he just kind of wanted to chill out for a little while and didn't want to keep, you know, I think that if my memory serves me. Does that sound right?
That sounds about right, because I think the Megadeth thing came to a screeching halt, I'm going to say, sometime October. It was not too long after 9/11 in 01, right? And then the TSO tour was geared up to start not too long after that. And I think, yeah, now that you mention that, yeah, we were all pretty baked, but I just knew I wanted to go home to Paul O'Neill and help bring this thing to life that I was part of.
Yeah, he said here that he was exhausted and really sick, so he needed a chance to go home and relax. That's his words,
yeah,
right there. So anyways,
absolutely.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting how this world gets smaller and smaller the longer you're in it with all these guys that I know and stuff. But now you're in Nashville, and you got the Christmas spirit, I'm sure, flowing for the live event this coming Friday then, eh?
Yeah, dude, it's been like the most emotional / best couple weeks of my career because I'm so proud of everybody. You know, I mean, you know, going to rehearsal, yeah, that's familiar. You know, putting this music together, making sure everything's in place, that's familiar. But it's so unfamiliar in every other way, you know. I mean, when the tour was canceled, everybody's heart was broken, and it would have been the first time in 22 years that we didn't do this. So to have a swing at the place meant everything, you know. And then, you know, the importance of this show and how everybody just wants to do such an incredible job. I mean, again, not to beat a dead horse, man, but I'm just so proud of everybody.
Yeah, and now you're typically on the West Coast band, right?
Well, yeah.
Okay.
In 99, we did our first tour, and then in 2000, we had to cut it into two just to cover the country. So Paul said, okay, you go that way, and we'll go the other way.
Yeah, because I've never interviewed you, and I've only seen TSO a few times because of the way the schedule works out sometimes. I've never seen you play here before. But so who makes up TSO, the band that we're going to see this coming Friday?
Well, the coolest thing, or one of the coolest things about it, is it goes back to the original band from 99. So it's myself and Johnny Lee Middleton. We're going to join back up with Chris Caffrey and Jeff Plate. And, you know, we haven't played this music together literally since 99. Mm. So there's a certain chemistry and a lot of history behind the band. And then we got some singers from both sides who are going to be joining us.
Now, I know that, you know, this thing, of course, you always see the guys from TSO and stuff praising the military. You're the father of a couple of military sons, so that's got to be awfully proud for you to do this every year as well.
Oh, yeah, I'm so proud of all my children. I mean, hey, I got blessed with five kids. But
oh, I didn't know you had five kids. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, I've been busy in
I
the
guess.
Off season.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, listen, you know, every show I tip my hat to the military, you know, and I don't talk about my kids because I don't ever want to make it about me.
Right.
But a lot of people know that, you know, I do have, you know, selfish reasons for saying so because, look, when Paul wrote Christmas Eve and Other Stories, it was 25 years ago, okay? That made me about 33 or so, maybe 34. And I recorded a song called Ornament. And at the time I recorded it, Paul told me that, well, the song is about a father pleading to the heavens for the safe return of his teenage runaway daughter. Okay, my oldest son was probably, I don't know, 8 at the time.
Mm.
And
wow.
The song meant something to me then. But you fast forward all these years, and now he's a sniper in the Special Forces, and when we play that song, every time we play that song, I get a lump in my throat, because no matter what, he's still my baby boy.
You know?
So what I notice about Paul's story is that if you insert your circumstance to his words, the story does become about you, because I miss all my kids. You know, my middle son's a touring musician. Well, up until this year, he was a touring musician. My youngest son is on a nuclear submarine out of Seattle. And then my two baby girls are here, you know, under the roof with us. So, but, you know, you pull me away from any of my children for any length of time, I miss them horribly. You know, so, you know, Paul's songs, I know, mean a lot to the world and a lot to the community that's embraced TSO, but everybody should know, listen, it means as much to everybody in the band as well.
And even though you can't go on tour and stuff with TSO, it'll be good. It's kind of a double-edged sword that you'll be able to spend time, maybe more time with your family.
Listen, I'm always going to look at the glass half full. I mean, you know, but take me out of the conversation for a minute. You know, we always have to remember how many hundreds of thousands of people have died from this disgusting thing, and how many people are suffering, like, just insurmountable loss and, you know, financial ruin and all that. So I don't want to make light of it. I'm not going to sit here, well, hey, you know, this has been pretty cool for me. No, it's been horrible for everybody.
Right.
But I'm going to walk out of this, like, this will end one day, and I think I'm going to be a better human, a better man, a better father because of it, because it's taught me, like, listen, tomorrow's never guaranteed. And that's become really apparent now. And I'm learning to take time and live in the moment and spend every second, with the exception of these couple weeks of rehearsing for, you know, this incredible thing Friday night, you know, every second hanging out with my wife and my kids and like, just going, you know what, man, I'm not going to worry about anything other than what I'm doing right now. And if that means I'm going to play Chutes and Ladders or Candyland or Operation, or if I got to listen to one more Disney soundtrack, you know, I'm going to put a smile on my face and enjoy it, because I have the opportunity to have all this extra time with the ones that I love.
Well, and just say yes to everything, like you say. So the yes man, there you go.
Just say yes to everything, dude. At the end of the day, that's the safest way to get through it.
I just shared a couple text messages with my friend Bumblefoot, who you share your birthday with. And by the way, Bumblefoot hasn't missed a note since the Clinton era, so he sends his best as well. So
much love. Man, what a great guitar player. Holy Christ.
Yeah, he's good. And you're not so bad yourself. So we'll look forward to seeing you this coming Friday. Of course, the live stream, and people can check out the website right here, WRIF.com, and get all the info and buy their packages there. And Al, good to hear your voice again, and I'll be looking for that Widowmaker tour next year.
All right, me and you both, my brother. Stay safe. Much love, okay?
All right, thanks, Al. We'll see you
next time.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Picking five of Carrie Underwood's best music videos was no easy task, but after some debate, we landed on five we believe rise to the top. Did Carrie's 2014 hit Something in the Water make our top five? Find out when you text Carrie to 45911 and scroll through the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Carrie to 45911 to get your eyes on our favorite Carrie Underwood music videos.
Up next, it's Jason Buehler. Songs for the Apocalypse comes out on January 22nd, and got some great guests on this record. Let me see if I can run down some of the people who are on this album, okay? David Ellison from Megadeth. Bumblefoot is on there as well. Jeff Scott Soto. Let's see. Devin Townsend's on there. Todd LaTorre from Queensryche playing drums, if you can believe that. Pat Badger's on there. Ricky Sanders, Butch Walker. Kyle Sanders, of course, from Hell Yeah. Stephen Gibb. Clay Cook, who we talk about coming up in the interview. I mean, just a plethora of stars. Clint Lowry, can't forget about him. So lots of stars on this record, lots of great musicians. Songs for the Apocalypse, like I said, drops on January 22nd, and I've had a chance to listen to it, and it's pretty intense. It's really cool. I really enjoyed checking it out. So let's talk with Jason and see what he has to say about that, the album, and tons more today on Talkin' Rock. All right, Jason, how's things, man?
Everything's great, man.
Awesome.
How about yourself?
You got this new record coming out January 22nd. Now, I've seen 22nd. I've seen the 21st. So just correct me. Is it the 22nd?
I believe it's the 22nd.
Okay, Songs for the Apocalypse. And so you sent me the advanced copy of it last night, and I messaged you last night, and I don't want you to think I was just BSing you. This record is amazing.
Oh, man. Thanks so much, man. I mean, I'm super glad you dig it, because it's definitely for a select group of people that will take that ride. I mean, it goes from kind of one end of the spectrum to the other. So I'm glad you dig it. It's awesome.
No, when I listen to it, I think to myself, well, first of all, let me ask you this. How long did it take you to make this record? Because to me, it sounds like there's a lot of thought and a lot of process that went into making this album.
I started writing in March, and we were done mixing in the beginning of May, so about 2 months.
So that's not that long at all, because it really sounds really well thought out. There's a use of soundscapes in there, non-instrument instruments. It's just like it has this aura about it. You can visualize videos when you're listening to it. I mean, it's really spectacular.
Thanks. Yeah, I mean, we've known each other a while, but it's like, for me, like, even going back to the Saigon Kick days, I mean, we always kind of didn't play in the sandbox very well with others.
Right.
We had one or two songs that were of this genre, a song that was this genre. So we managed to kind of create this ecosystem where, hair metal bands didn't really accept us, and then we were never really accepted by the grunge bands either. So we kind of went down this middle road. My whole life, I've just been a music fan. So, I mean, I love... You'll literally look at my playlist and probably want to call the police, because I'll put Barry Manilow next to Meshuggah, next to Bjork. I just love music. So that all kind of blends up in my head over the years of my whole life. I mean, from the Beatles to Motown to Tom Waits to, Kojira to, jazz, Miles Davis. It doesn't matter to me. I just love great stuff. So somehow it gets all screwed up in my head and blended and comes out into this kind of, world that I think the record kind of lives in.
No, it was great, man. I was listening to it last night, and right off the bat, I'm like, wow, this is really cool. David Ellefson said in a, I think a post, or I don't know if he texted to me or not, he says, the record's like 90125 from Yes meets Soulfly. And I'm like, okay. And he called you a modern-day Zappa, which is pretty high praise.
I think I'd be better off saying I'm the modern-day Jesus. In terms of trying to avoid trouble.
I can already see the headlines now.
Beeler turns down comparison to Zappa for one of Jesus. Look, it doesn't get any high. I mean, Zappa's a god amongst... I mean, to even be mentioned in that context, I think he just means in the sense where, not to speak for him, it's just such high praise, it's hard to digest that. There's many... things you can take that's just as good as it gets. So, I mean, and Dave is such an amazing musician, all these guys, that's the biggest thing about, I mean, for me, the whole goal was, selfishly, I was like, I have a bunch of friends that I love and respect and admire, and I'm a fan of, and I'm going to call a bunch of them. And I kind of assumed that just due to the nature of life and touring and creativity that, people would be doing stuff. So I might get two or three of my buddies or four of my buddies. And the first thing that just blew me away was that everybody instantly said yes and was like, yeah, absolutely, let's do it. So that actually created a different problem to where I was even going to do stuff potentially with like Corey Taylor, and I just didn't have time and didn't have the songs yet. So hopefully it'll be a part two. But to get to work with these guys and have a guy like David Ellefson, who's, I mean, I grew up listening to that, MTV Peace Sells bass riff. I mean, it's in my head. It's part of my DNA. And, and not to mention all the other guys. I mean, Devin Townsend, Foot Lowery, or Bumblefoot. I mean, Butch Walker, or even Clay Cook from the Zac Brown Band. I mean, I think that's really what I'm most proud of, is that we kind of created this world where, if I told you, the guitar player from Zac Brown Band is on a record with Bumblefoot, you'd be like, what? Like, how is that? How does Devin Townsend get on a record with Butch Walker? How does this kind of – and I'm really proud that we made something, that kind of lives in that really – cool world where everybody just is such a big fan of overall music. That was the coolest thing I walked away from, is like, all these guys are just music fans, so everybody's into what everybody else is doing and is aware of what everyone else was doing, and it's just such a great experience. So selfishly, that's just really the whole goal, is to make a record with these guys. And I'm not saying that I don't care. I mean, I'd love to have it do well, and the fact that it's all of a sudden, like, I'm on these new prog metal lists and all these new people are discovering, it's fantastic. But the whole goal was to really just do something with them. And so everything from this point forward has just been like such an unbelievable, like, I keep waking up going, you got to be kidding me. That's amazing. This is brilliant.
And now David and Bumblefoot can say they're part of the Baron von Bielski orchestra, right? Is that right? They can do that now. Put it on their resume.
They can officially do that, although I am not paying scale.
Yeah, I texted David and Bumblefoot yesterday, and they couldn't say enough good things about you. Bumblefoot says that you're one of the most creative and funniest people he's ever worked with.
Well, I mean, if you know Bumblefoot, that's, that feels like I'm looking in a mirror, because I think he's a genius. I mean, he is so funny, that, and enjoyable, and just obviously beyond talented. I mean, it's so, like, just to give you an idea of how talented he is, Bumblefoot, like, and me had met a few years ago, and we kind of were social, but I don't think he had any clue as to anything I've done in my past. And Jeff Soto and I were going to do this acoustic show in New York City. We went around the country doing these different shows, which were actually doing great. They were starting to sell out. And I was like, you know, I'm such a big fan of Bumblefoot. Just have him come out and, like, jam a song or something, you know, hope, you know. So the guy shows up, has no idea a note of music, and plays two back-to-back two-hour sets with us, including singing harmony on songs he's never heard before.
That sounds like him, yeah.
And messed up less than I did. And I wrote the song.
Right. Yeah, you just give him a little bit of lead and he just goes. So is there anybody, you said, you know, you mentioned that, you know, you got all these friends that you want to get a project. Is there anybody that's just for whatever reason couldn't do it?
No one said no. I mean, strangely enough, I think it came more to time constraints and the label's lack of putting out a ninefold album. At this point. So hopefully, I've been speaking with Corey about doing something and that'd be amazing. And there's so many other musicians that I've just become fans of. And I think, you know, not that there's a bright side to a pandemic, but the wonderful thing about the timing is that everybody's around, which probably won't be the case, you know, hopefully will be the case in 6 to 8 months from now. I hope life turns back to kind of normal and everyone can get back to playing shows and being out there. So to take advantage of the fact that everybody's home creatively is just seems like the right thing to do.
Now, all things, let's say things do get back to normal. Do you have a plan to maybe tour with this, or would you go out and tour with something like this, or is this kind of something you just put out there and I'll let the fans take in? What is your plan for the future with this project?
You know, I definitely want to tour it. I think the record is going to be super challenging and fun to bring out into a live context. So that's definitely going to happen. When is the question? Mm-hmm. And it's been so, like I said, like, you know, it's neat because obviously I have this first part of my career, which involved a certain group of people. But all of a sudden, like, I'm in these prog metal lists and all these different things. So, like, you know, bands that like Steven Wilson and, you know, all these other bands are like kind of starting to float in that ecosystem. So I'm getting tons of people that have like had no clue about the past or Saigon Kick or anything. So I'm hoping it creates a really great touring environment where, you know, we take the core of what we have and the people that obviously do know what I do and just make it bigger and grow. So I'm looking forward to it.
Now, what would it take for this album to be like a success in your eyes? Like, what would be a successful record?
It already is for me. And I don't mean to say that sounds like a stupid ass answer.
No, I hear you.
I mean, to make a record like this at this point in my career with all my buddies, I'm thrilled. Every day, like, I wake up and something else extra happens that's nice. It's just wonderful. So, I mean, if it sells, you know, 10,000 copies, that's fantastic. If it sells 100,000 copies, brilliant. I've been around long enough to know that, you know, some days you're going to sell and some days you're not.
Yeah.
And the reward to me, and I think the reason why I've stayed in the business so long and been generally semi-mentally stable is I don't live about that. You know, I live for making music and creating music and being around people I think are talented and getting to engage with people that dig the music. So sometimes that's going to be thousands of people. Sometimes it may be hundreds of people. But that's where my mindset is. So, because I think you can get in a real dangerous area if you're like, you know, if it's not a hit, you know, then I'm going to be, you know, because you can't, I mean, you really can't control that. I mean, you know, even bands like, and not equating myself with Aerosmith, but if you look at the arc of their career, or you look at the arc of the Chili Peppers, or you look at the arc of bands that have been around forever, you know, there's highs and lows. And I think you just, overall, I think when you sit back after a long time, you realize, look, I've been making music professionally since I'm 18. I'm as lucky as you get. I mean, sure, there's Led Zeppelin and the Beatles, but I mean, there's a lot of talented people out there that are working construction.
Right. And they're good at construction.
And they're good at construction too, which I am not. So
right.
I think they're more talented than me.
Yeah, that makes two of us, that's for sure. So, you know, we were just talking about Zappa and stuff. Have you seen that Zappa documentary, the latest film that just came out last week?
I did, yeah.
How amazing is that guy,
cool.
Huh?
Man, I mean, it's like, that's why when David was saying that, I was like, you know, you never want to correct somebody on their comparison for you being so wonderful. And I was like, are you sure you weren't thinking, you want to shoot a little lower there, bud?
Hey, you know what you need? You need a film crew following you around 24/7. That's really what you need. Then a giant vault of all the stuff.
yeah, that would make my wife very, very happy because, you know, I spend my days just trying to explain to her how lucky she is. So having my own roaming film crew would really push her over the top.
I might give you my wife's number to tell her how lucky she is as well. Hey, so you just talked, you know, we were talking about Saigon Kick and stuff. I want to switch gears here just a little bit. So Saigon Kick, you know, in the early 1990s and stuff, and you're saying, like, you know, the hair metal guys really, you know, didn't get you guys, the grunge guys. It was kind of a weird time because that was when I first got into radio, and, you know, you guys were around for a couple years, and it was a really kind of weird time. It's weird some of the bands that broke. Like, I was the first guy in the country to play the Lumberjack by Jackal. And, of course, Jackal really popped, really, you know, in 1992. The Black Crows. There was these kind of bands, even like a Firehouse a little bit, to say they had some of these hits, even though the times and the trajectory of music was changing. Tell me about your thoughts about when Saigon Kick was really popping.
Well, when we started, we were just blissfully ignorant, and I don't think in the same exact sense, but we just made any music we wanted to make. And since I wrote most of the stuff, it's all my fault. But but you know, so like I was into punk, I was into Jane's Addiction, I was into, you know, and I just grew up as too ugly of a person to ever succeed in hair metal.
That makes two of us, yeah.
so you know, that wasn't going to be in the cards. Me flaunting my slightly paunchy body around in spandex was not going to move the units that Atlantic Records was hoping for.
Right.
So we were initially out there, you know, on tour with, you know, the Ramones, and we played with Faith No More, and we were playing with Soundgarden, and we played, and then strangely enough, we played with bands like Cheap Trick, and we did stuff with Ozzy. And even on our first record, it was pretty diverse. I mean, there was some really heavy stuff, some, you know, alternative, strange, experimental stuff, and then there's a ballad or softer songs. And I mean, I never apologize. I mean, I love, like I said, I will get in the pit at a Barry Manilow show. So, like, I have no shame. I mean, to me, I've always liked songs. So, and the second record came out after we were kind of on this trajectory. And I think it came, you know, I like to think that we had the ballad that killed hair metal.
Mm. You
know, it was the last one. Like, I put, that's why all the hair metal guys hate us, because we put everybody out of work. So, like, it was like, that was the final ballad, which really, when you think about it, paved the way for grunge. So I like to think of myself as the godfather of grunge, because had I not killed hair metal off, I mean, Nevermind and Soundgarden would have never happened.
So. Okay, I'm sorry. I'm not laughing at you. I'm laughing with you.
Dave Grohl would be painting houses if it weren't for me.
So. Okay, all right. So I'm talking to the godfather of grunge, so go ahead.
So, I mean, and then we were in Mexico shooting a video for a song on the second record called Hostile Youth, with actually the guy who did the Jane's Addiction documentary called Gift. And I remember getting a call from Atlantic. I think it was Doug Morris at the time, who said, like, you know, hey, this radio station just started playing the ballad, and it's exploding. It's, you know, it's selling ridiculous amounts of records. So it was look, it's never a bad thing to have a lot of people pick up music that you made. And we made that record. And, you know, it's not like it was snuck up on us or something, stuck it on the record and we weren't aware. I mean, we made the record.
Yeah.
It wasn't something, we didn't intend to have it go out that way per se. And it exploded. It became a hit. So, you know, I'm smart enough to see that, like, okay, Alice in Chains is having, you know, success with, you know, this Man in a Box and, you know, all these kind of songs. We might not be seen as the coolest new grunge band. having a number one ballad, a number one song on MTV with a ballad. So, yeah, just put us right down the middle of this kind of area. But I think, you know, there's a few bands that fell in that space, you know, like King's X, I think, did. And
yeah.
Extreme did, for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, there's another band that really wasn't, nothing Saigon Kick ever did was about, like, hot chicks and cars and racing down the motorway and, we weren't really lyrically tuned to, but then again, we weren't really a grunge band either. So I think the dysfunctional soundscapes of what we've always done is why there's still some sense of it being interesting to some people now, or a lot of people are even discovering it now, like for the first time and going, oh, wow. Like, I didn't know that was about on this record, or that's what these guys were about, you know? So I guess that's the best summary I can give you.
Yeah, it's interesting because, Love Is On The Way came out, and it's like, it didn't really, like, I don't know, like you're saying, like your records were all over the place, but that kind of, in a little bit of a way, do you think it pigeonholes you? Do you think it helped or hindered? Or do you think, like, as soon as that hit kind of fizzled out, that was it? Or, you follow what I'm saying?
Yeah, it's hard to ever know. I mean, I was never this guy that wanted to be playing, you know, shitty clubs in front of 50 people when I was in my 50s, but be super credible.
Right.
Like, that just never happened. So, I mean, I always wanted to have the records be heard by a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know that the soccer mom contingent was prepared for our live show or what we were about. So, you know, we didn't make, you know, it's funny because I think now, like, even with my son, I think we talked about hockey before my son plays college type now, but, you know, it's like all those kids now in his age group, like, they don't give a shit about genre. Like, they'll go Rihanna, Metallica, AC/DC, you know, EDM. Jack
exactly.
Brown,
yep. Yeah. You're right. Yeah.
So people just listen to music now.
Right.
As to where, like, when we were growing up, it was like you were the punk kid, you were the new wave girl, you were at the heavy metal table, you know, and you never talked. Like, you'd fight somebody over Ace Frehley and Eddie Van Halen conversations,
right,
you know?
Right.
Now I think they don't, you know, I don't think my son realizes that AC/DC is in their 60s or 70s. Like, they're just a great rock band.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, they don't think about the way we thought about it. And so, yeah, I mean, having a ballad, I think, exposed the band to a tremendous amount more people than we would have been. But obviously, you know, when any genre becomes super cool, like grunge, or even hair metal before it, or you know, compare, I mean, you got to remember what, like, I think bands like Van Halen did to, like, a lot of the new wave movement.
Mm, yeah.
You know, it was a similar time where, like, you know, all that Flock of Seagulls stuff was as cool as possible, and then it just all of a sudden wasn't. But I think when you look back at it historically, there's so many great new wave bands, there's so many great 80s bands, 90s bands. I think people don't care anymore. They just want to hear good songs.
Yeah, and it's so funny you mentioned, you know, that, you know, your management or whatever said that, you know, Love Is On The Way is getting some radio play and stuff like that. And I remember one time Robbie and Johnny from the Goo Goo Dolls came into the studio in Buffalo when I was on the air, and I said to Johnny, I said, dude, sorry, man, I played the wrong song. I played this song called Name on accident. And he's like, oh, thanks, man. Like, he was kind of bummed out, right? So I guess I'm kind of the godfather of the Goo Goo Dolls then, right?
See, you and me both have destroyed modern music with a single mistake.
Yeah.
I always go back to the point that, you know, I have a really nice house.
Right.
So I'm not complaining.
Right. Exactly.
You know what I mean? It's not all bad. You know, it was a wonderful thing to have a hit. And anytime you create something that a lot of people like, I mean, it's never a bad thing. I mean, you can't time cool or being a part of it any more than, like, you know, I remember when, you know, Limp Bizkit was going to be, you couldn't have been cooler.
Yeah, that's true, yeah.
You just couldn't have been. And then, you know, ultimately it turns on them and all of a sudden you couldn't be less cool. And then if you stay around long enough, you realize, hey, some of those songs were really cool. You know, they were really good songs, or they weren't. Or, you know, ultimately you'll live or die, I think, by, you know, If the songs hold up. I mean, I remember when Bon Jovi was, like, not taken seriously for years again, like, after his big peak. It was like, you know, and then all of a sudden, he's the greatest thing. You know, he's a legacy. He's considered, like, one of the greats of rock.
Yeah.
But I remember that there was a rough time there when hair metal was kind of on the outs. And but now you look back and you go, no, you know, those are great songs, man.
Yeah,
you know.
It is funny to think about some of the bands because, you know, Bon Jovi was right there in the middle of all the hair metal stuff. But a lot of the bigger hair metal bands, the Motleys and the, you know, Guns N' Roses to a certain degree, they might have had a little bit of a hiccup in the road, but they all came back, you know, somewhat, I suppose. I mean, you know, Bon Jovi obviously playing stadiums and GNR playing stadiums and Motley was about to play stadiums. So I guess, but like, you're right. It's like good music's good music. And now all these people are discovering it many years later and they weren't around back then or weren't aware of it, or whatever the case is.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't mean this as a derogatory thing at any, because I have ultimate respect, but I mean, Alice in Chains was a glam band. Yeah. Pantera was a glam band.
Right, right.
They were just far smarter than Saigon Kick and transitioned before, right? You know, before things started to become, they sensed it coming. As we blissfully, ignorantly walked right in and, like, here's, you know, this is what we're doing, and weren't paying attention. So, I mean, we didn't care. So we would tour with Rat, but we would also tour with the Ramones.
Right.
You know, we just weren't, I don't want to say smart enough. I think blissfully ignorant is a better way of putting it. We just did what we did. And, you know, that's how it played out.
Now, I'm not trying to get, like, clickbait or nothing like that, but where does Saigon Kick stand right now? Because according to, like, Wikipedia and stuff, when I was looking it up earlier, there is still a band and there's past members. So do you guys have any plans to play, or I don't even know where you guys stand right now.
We tried to do some reunion dates, like, 4 or 5 years ago, and we did about 10 shows, like, L.A., New York, Chicago. That went well. It was nice to be in a room and not kill each other.
Yeah.
So that was a victory in and of itself. But I just, it's not for me anymore. And I think, I'm sure it's not for them, and I'm sure it's not for them either. You know, it's just, I want to pursue and do what I'm doing. I'm having a blast. And I'm never a never say never guy. You never know what the world turns into in the future.
Right.
It just holds no interest for me. I mean, in the same way, I think it reminds me of, like, you know, if you had an ex-girlfriend and all of a sudden you went to dinner with her like 10 years later, and at dinner, it's like, wow, like, so awesome. And these conversations. So I remember all these great things. And then you see her the next day and you're like, oh, there she is. There. Now I remember.
Yeah, right. I know, you know, people don't realize that aren't in a band, and I'm not either. I'm just, you know, I fly solo, like, you know, I don't have to worry about other people. But yeah, when you're traveling on the road with 4 or 5 other guys or whatever, it's like, you know, I can imagine that things happen. And people, you know, and you, can you see why people would say, like, for example, you know, name the band. Why can't they just get, you know, bury the hatchet and get back together? You can see why people say that, right?
Oh, of course. As a fan, like, I mean, you know, it's I'm friends with the guys in Skid Row. Scotty's a buddy of mine. He's a great guy. And on a fan level, I'm like, you know, Sebastian, I'd love to see Skid Row, like, the way I remember it as a fan. We played with him early on in Saigon Kick. I mean, like, that would be awesome. As a human being, and not taking anybody's side, because I don't, you know, Sebastian's always been cool to me and Scotty's always been cool to me. But obviously there's problems. But as a human being, like, Scotty wants to be happy. Sebastian wants to be happy.
Yeah. How could,
you know, I, as a human being and as a person on the who's had band difficulties, I totally get it. Like, you know, I mean, life's too short, you know, to be miserable, regardless of the cause. So, I mean, I get both sides of it. But as a fan, I mean, I know what I want to see, and I totally respect people saying that.
Yeah, you always think there's a way that they could just, you know, just, you know, be with each other for that hour and a half on stage, then, like, you know, the other, you know, 22 and a half hours just be separated. But, you know, I know that that's probably just wishful thinking on a lot of fans' parts, you know, that could, something like that could happen, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I totally get it. I mean, I feel the same way about fans that I love or would like to see, you know, do stuff or put, you know, bury the hatchet. But with us, unfortunately, the hatchet gets buried in someone's head. So,
all right. Well, final question here for you, then we'll let you fly, Jason. So, what is your most favorite Photoshop picture of you that's on the internet?
That's difficult to say. That is really difficult to say. You know, it's the guy who did all the artwork for this record. His name is Robert Merrick, and he's a genius. And we've been friends for years. And our friendship basically started, I don't even know how. And then during his downtime between whatever he was doing, he would send me these, like, insane photos, which would just crack me up, and I'd upload it. And the best part of them is that because of the nature of the just idiocy of the world we live in, you know, you have a large contingent of people who have no idea they're Photoshopped.
Right.
So I've had these, like, wonderful comments. Like, this one time he Photoshopped me on, you know, that George Costanza picture, like, The Art of Seduction?
Oh, yeah.
When he's like in boxer shorts, he's on the couch. And,
right.
You know, so he puts my head on, he does a good job of it. And this girl, like, sends me a message. Like, I just want to say that it's so wonderful for a man your size to not be body shamed and to get, like, this whole really uplifting, like, positive response. And like, to me, I was like, that's why the internet was invented. This is exactly what the highest calling of intellectual brilliance that the internet can produce is what this is all about.
Well, that is hysterical. Yeah. But, hey, listen, man, by the way, the cover art is really cool. It kind of reminds me, it's not like it, but it kind of reminds me a little bit of the latest Ozzy album. It's kind of like that darkness and stuff, you know, and with the top hat and the whole thing, you know?
There will be a lawsuit.
you're going to sue Ozzy, aren't you?
Unfortunately, Unfortunately, I'll lose that one. But,
you should sue Ozzy for stealing your idea before you got it.
Hey, press is press, right? I mean, someone's got to pay attention.
That's right. Jason Bieler's new record, the Baron von Bielski Orchestra. Is that, am I saying this even close to correct?
Dude, you're on it, man. You're killing it.
All right. Songs for the Apocalypse comes out on January 22nd. All sorts of guests. And seriously, dude, I wouldn't just blow smoke. It's a killer album. I'm going to have to say it's vinyl worthy. I'm going to have to get it on vinyl now, you see?
There's a double vinyl.
Is there a double? Okay, cool.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Strangely enough, we set up this whole thing, and the initial print sold out. But I'll send you one. Just email me.
All right, cool, man. Well, I appreciate that. Well, Jason, thanks so much for the time, man. Great to catch up, and thanks for the laughs. This might have been my funniest interview of the whole year.
Awesome.
Yeah, you know who else was really funny one time, and I don't know if he meant to be funny, but Neil from Clutch had me, like, crying one time. Do you know Neil?
No, I don't. I know the band, obviously, but yeah. I don't know him personally.
Neil is really, like, dry and stuff, but he was telling me how he was pitching baseballs to his six-year-old. And his six-year-old told him he was the worst pitcher in the world. Like, his six-year-old's been, you know, like, a lot of people have pitched to him, apparently. So it was just really funny. He had to kind of be in the moment. But that was one of the funniest things I've ever heard. But, no, The Godfather of Grunge, I like that. That's going to be a headline I could tell already, so.
Thank you very much. I'm sure I can't wait for the hate. Between that and the Zappa comparison, I should be done with my career in about 15 minutes here, so.
All right, man. I'm gonna stop this. Thanks so much for the time, Jason.
Hey, thank you for having me, man. I really appreciate it.
That may have been my funnest conversation of 2020. We may have saved the best for almost the last. I do have some more interviews coming up here before we close up shop for 2020. But got to thank Jason and Al for taking the time today to talk about their respective projects. Hope you guys dug this conversation. Conversations. If you did, 5-star reviews, you can share with your friends. Of course, subscribe. Check back often as we'll be talking to a lot of people coming up. I know Brian Wheat from Tesla is coming up, and I might phone in some favors to some of my friends coming up here to maybe give you guys some content between the holidays as well when I'm actually on vacation. But thank you guys so much for checking out Talkin' Rock. I love doing this, and we'll do it all over again very shortly.
Thank you for listening to Talkin' Rock with Meltdown. You can help this podcast grow by giving it a 5-star rating and writing a review on Apple and iTunes. Plus, feel free to subscribe and share it with your friends. Until next time, thanks for listening to Talkin' Rock.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Picking 5 of Carrie Underwood's best music videos was no easy task, but after some debate, we landed on 5 we believe rise to the top. Did Carrie's 2014 hit Something in the Water make our top 5? Find out when you text Carrie to 45911 and scroll through the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Carrie to 45911 to get your eyes on our favorite Carrie Underwood music videos.